Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Clean Tech, a roundup of the week's biggest stories you need to know in climate and clean energy in 15 minutes or less. Today is Friday, January 12th, 2024. I'm Renewable Energy World Editor-in-Chief John Engle. We'll have Mario Ariza from Floodlight News joining us shortly, but I'm joined for the first time in the new year by PR veteran of clean tech and all other industries of TigerCom, Mike Casey. How are you, Mike?
I'm good, sir. Listen, I've got some bad news to break to you. Claire has told me that over the break, we got 54,271 complaining emails that you did not put on an elf cap before Christmas. And people are, our readers and listeners are outraged that you did not join in the holiday spirits. I think you need to own that and just make a promise you can do better in 12 months.
I'll own it. I won't change that strategy because the internet is forever, Mike, and you will be on the internet forever looking like one of Santa's elves. We want to thank all of you for joining us for another episode and for your support and sending in those article recommendations and nominations for Clean Tech of the Week. You can send those to REW at clarionevents.com. We'll have a link in the episode description as well. Okay, Mike, our first one of the new year. Get us started.
Yeah, we got a story written by Henry Sanderson from Foreign Affairs titled "The Problem with De-risking Transition to Clean Energy Requires Trade with China." John, what'd you think?
Yeah, so despite inventing key clean energy tech in the 20th century, the West failed to capitalize on its early lead, allowing China to dominate the sector in large part because of their policies and initiatives. Now, Western countries have agreed to leverage quote unquote de-risking strategies or ways to maintain trading ties to protect global clean energy supply chains with China. Henry points out that Western leaders believe in incentivizing clean energy through subsidies, which may be ineffective in competing with China. He argues that this strategy could lead to an investment shift to the highest bidder rather than to who is making the best sustainable technology and maybe wasting taxpayer money along the way. Mike, what did you think?
I think perhaps this quote summarizes the piece best. Quote, instead, Western governments should think carefully about how to compete with Beijing for the long haul. So yes, we are wise to acknowledge that China's presence in clean tech is kind of like the fossil fuel lobby. It's not going anywhere. But I'll add here that the ideology over reality crowd has to be confronted through some inconvenient facts. One, we invented all this stuff, and then we handed off leadership to China. Two, for all the political bloviating about China building coal plants, they are surging ahead with their clean energy transition. And three, we still have to deal with deniers of climate science and climate solutions. So de-risking supply chains is the task at hand. And I got to credit Henry with a thoughtful perspective, even if the difficulty ratio of recommending versus doing is pretty lopsided. What's for certain is this is the discussion that the intelligentsia should have. John, story number two.
Yeah, this is from previous guest and Semaphore writer Tim McDonnell, titled Housing Windfall. Mike, what'd you take away?
Yeah, a really good reporting by Tim here. U.S. government researchers found that property values drop 11% when a new wind farm is announced within 1 mile of a home, but they rebound to their pre-construction levels within just a few years after that wind farm is built, and those neighbors immediately benefit from their communities seeing jobs, economic activity, and for decades from the ongoing tax revenue. Obviously, I'm adding that last part. This impact is predominantly observed in proximity to in urban areas, with rural areas experiencing a comparatively lesser effect. John, what'd you think?
Yeah, so a few years ago, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory surveyed wind farm neighbors and found 51% living within a half mile radius of a wind farm actually had a very positive or positive experience. The same lab recently found, though, that houses located within a half mile of utility scale solar farms experienced just a 1.5% decline in resale prices when contrasted with homes between 2 and 4 miles away. Again, not taking into account those financial benefits that come to landowners and communities. Contrast that with the residents' concerns of 40% fall, a 40% fall in home values is what they expected, but that did not thankfully materialize. Mike, what's our third story?
We have a story from Ty Gillespie at Bloomberg titled "Smart Energy Use Draws Big Money from Private Equity." John?
Yeah, we've discussed this on previous episodes. Wind and solar power developers have faced rising interest rates and supply chain issues. Natural gas prices have jumped during the global energy crisis as well. This has led investment firms to put billions towards something different, energy efficiency, and more specifically, companies and technologies that reduce energy waste on assembly lines in office buildings and farms. Mike, what'd you take away?
I've long felt that energy efficiency doesn't get the love it should, and I'm really psyched that it's becoming more of a trend. And Emma Champion, an energy transition analyst at Bloomberg New Energy Finance, has highlighted the need to both build more energy infrastructure, but also enhance how efficiently we use energy in the first place. I mean, it has also become an alternative to the highly politicized conversations around renewables. By using energy efficiently, we're considering financial savings, national security, and protecting the climate all in one. I mean, here's the bottom line. Waste is dumb, and it's a sign of market inefficiency, and everyone, and I mean everyone, should be in favor of us cutting our energy waste. John, what's our fourth story?
All right, number four comes from Jennifer Kingston with Axios, titled "New York Jumpstarts the Building Decarbonization Trend." Mike?
13% of carbon pollution in the U.S. is caused by residential and commercial buildings. And up to this point, policies penalizing building owners for excessive carbon pollution have been embraced by just 4 states and 9 cities. Now a metropolis filled with skyscrapers is entering the mix. You might have heard of it. It's called New York City. So this is huge considering that 2/3 of New York City's carbon pollution comes from buildings. John, what do you think?
Annual financial penalties are at $268 per ton of CO2 equivalent over an individual building's limit for violators. And this goes into effect January 20th. So over the next 16 years, those financial penalties will get progressively stricter. Some developers and landlords are fearful preparing for the costs of taking out gas-burning heaters and retrofitting older structures, but others are looking forward to the money savings on their utility bills. Policies like this do encourage carbon management in new construction, making buildings low carbon or even carbon negative from the start, which is certainly a good thing. Mike, our last story.
It's written by 3 reporters, Mario Alejandro Ariza and Christy Schwartz from Floodlight News. They're joined by Adam Mahoney from Capital B. It's called "Power Companies Paid Civil Rights Leaders in the U.S. South. They Became Loyal Industry Advocates." John, what'd you think?
Yeah, so here's the top line before we bring Mario in. So power companies have been paying millions to civil rights leaders and their groups in the U.S. South since at least 2009. We have a former state representative from Florida associated with a clandestine nonprofit group receiving funding from power company consultants to oppose rooftop solar projects. And Black civil rights leaders in the Southeast were targeted by power companies to gain support and divert attention from environmental harms that would disproportionately affect Black communities. Mario, you and your colleagues have done some incredible work on this piece. And one of the points you mentioned is a consultancy working to influence the JEA and Florida Power and Light controversy. I was there in Jacksonville when that first got started. So there's some overlap there, but interested in your biggest takeaways from the piece and what you learned.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having us on and for reading. I really appreciate it. So essentially, I want to situate this piece in this investigation into our ongoing look at the corporate influence campaigns that the utility industry has been paying for and effectuating across the United States and in the Southeast, particularly where we have these very large monopoly vertically integrated utilities. And these utilities are engaging in what they would characterize as the democratic process as a way to achieve their policy goals and gain strategic depth. It just happens that the way that they do this is very difficult to follow and very difficult to understand. And you know, essentially transparency here is at a minimum. And this is a 7-month investigation into the relationships between these Black civil rights groups and the power companies. What we do have to foreground is that nobody pays for civil rights work, right? This is very, very important work in very vulnerable communities that don't have a lot of extra money sloshing around to begin with. And so we were very careful to frame this story around the fact that these consultants working for these power companies were able to take advantage of this sort of strategic void and step in to fill it.
You know, Mario, I'm reminded when I read this story that you guys did a lot of good work exposing the FP&L Matrix scandal. And you just, I wrote about your piece on LinkedIn and I said, it was my opening sentence was sad, telling, and important to pay attention to, because this is the way that mature industries play. You know, you can take it personally. You can be offended that they do this. And I suppose the offense is there to be taken. But, you know, I think the real lesson for people in our sectors is we're not going to be Elmer Fudd and kind of scale our disruptive businesses under their nose without their paying attention. They're going to react. They are going to respond by using propaganda and disinformation and government influence to kind of water polo play, hold our heads underwater as we try to grow. And I have to tell you that the amount of awareness in the ranks of the listeners for John's show and this one is, it's just not great enough. So I think you've done us a big service, with this piece. I guess I'm going to ask, is there more there that we're going to see coming from Floodlight on this topic?
That's something that we've been asking ourselves in the Floodlight newsroom, right? There's thousands and thousands of pages of Matrix documents, but these documents are from a particular time period. And as we move forward every day, they sort of go into the past. So does it make sense to keep focusing on them? That's a ongoing editorial discussion. I can tell you that taken together, the documents are a breathtaking vision into how politics really works in America. And I think, you know, just understanding at the base level, this is a kind of understanding that I wish every individual in a politics classroom had, right? This is something that they should teach you in your civics courses, right? Like, this is how large corporations affect change in your current democratic system. Whether or not we're going to make any normative statements about it is up to you. I'm the journalist. I'm just trying to describe it. It's strategies and tactics that I never imagined or dreamed of before I got my hands on these documents.
Mario, I mentioned the Florida Power and Light and JEA scandal earlier. And what I'm reminded of is the Florida Times Union columnist Nate Monroe, when he first was taking the lid off that whole thing and opened everyone's eyes to what was going on. One of those Matrix photos documents was of him getting out of an Uber and letting his dog relieve himself on the side of the road. And that was, I'm not joking. That was being circulated as part of this by these consultants. And it's eye-opening and crazy to think that that's what's happening behind the scenes. But I'm interested if there's any one thing that stands out to you as most surprising from this reporting.
From this particular story, what really stood out to me was the way that, you know, we focused on the civil rights leaders because they are the symbols of moral authority, right? And they are doing, whether or not they took money, they're doing amazing and necessary work in their communities. And the fact that they took money, or that some of them took money, because not everybody in the piece took money, some people said, hey, no, especially the guy at our intro, right? It co-opts them and it keeps them from rightly negating or challenging the environmental impact of these utilities within their community. Especially look at Southern Company, right? It burns coal. It burns a lot of coal, and what it does with the coal ash, well, it's not really good for a lot of folks, right? And I don't think a lot of people would disagree with that. Perhaps Southern Company would. So what really surprised me the most, what really stood out to me, is that there's a rainbow of ways that Black civil rights leaders are dealing with this, right? And that they're making political decisions about this. And some of them are taking this money and establishing these relationships with these corporations in order to keep their organizations alive, right? And it's a tough spot to be in, but that's politics. And the fact that these corporations are using them for the strategic death is a whole nother thing. I was also really like, I couldn't bring this into four in the piece, right? But this is just one point of their outreach, right? It's not just the Black civil rights leaders. It's the outreach to the Black legislative state caucuses, the Black national congressional state caucuses. And the structure of, you know, trade group, consulting company, C4, then you have your trusted, you know, messenger going out to these communities. And then you're putting out these pieces of quote unquote scholarship showing that, you know, net metering is going to be terrible for minorities when there's less of a 1% adoption rate in most of the states where this guy's going to. That's how that works, right? But you have to climb all the rungs in order to explain it. And you got to keep people interested somehow too.
John, we're about out of time, but I do want to acknowledge Mario for this really incredible reporting. And I just want to encourage everybody in clean tech, if you're concerned about things like net metering 3.0 in California, and you want to know, how did we get here where tens of thousands of people in this sector are losing their jobs? You need to read this piece, because this is the way that those things get done. And I'm going to just suggest we pivot now to our clean techer of the week. Something a little unusual here. I'm going to nominate them, and we didn't even ask them. The intro here. Clean tech is hard. We all have bad days, and many of us are guaranteed to lose a job, lose an account, or even a company. And if that's an inevitability, then it's how we deal with that loss. It says something about our ability to succeed in the future. And for all those who've lost or will lose, I want to recommend you read Scott Kubley's courageous, forthright LinkedIn post. I've communicated with this person all of once in my life, but I was really inspired by his discussion about the end of his company, Cabana. And for that courage, I want to nominate Scott Kubley for our first Clean Techer of the Week for 2004. Thanks for showing us the way to get back on our feet, Scott.
And even 2024, he can have both of those years. Sorry, Mike. I wouldn't let it go. And thank you to Mario Ariza for joining us on this episode of This Week in Clean Tech. Please subscribe, give us feedback, share your story recommendations, and read Mario's piece. You can read all those stories by clicking the links in the episode description. And make sure to check out Monday's episode of Factor This. We're talking about the critical issue of transmission and why it isn't getting built fast enough in the U.S. Who is at fault? That's with one of the foremost researchers on the issue, Harvard Law's Ari Pesco. So you don't want to miss that one. Mike, I will see you next time. Thank you, Mario.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, folks.
Hey, it's John Engel, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.